more here. Oh, okay. Thank you very much, David, and the feelings are mutual. I really enjoyed Dr. Weiss's, Rabbi Dr. Weiss's presentation, and being a doctor of psychology and a rabbi is really not only a contradiction, but it's complementary. And the Torah is, in my opinion, the reason why the words of the Torah are so powerful is because they are a remarkable combination of philosophy and psychology. And the Torah recognizes that you must have both in order for a person to attain perfection. And I just want to elaborate on something. Some of you may wonder, well, what kind of psychology do we believe in? Freud, RET, or this or that? Let me just clear that away. The Torah's view is that it is extremely important for us to understand, to think about, and to be rational about our emotions, to have the ability to remove ourselves from our immediate emotion and to be able to think rationally and intelligently. The Torah does not mention a Freud or an Ellis or this particular psychology. The important thing of the Torah is to use the methodology of Torah to gain knowledge and to learn how to think properly and then to apply it to our emotions. That's exactly what is done in Ecclesiastes, as Rabbi Weiss explained, and in Proverbs. Of course, King Solomon never expected that he would give every last proverb. He just tried to give us a method and a basic approach and to show us that we should continue in this manner to explore and to be able to remove ourselves from the effects of our immediate emotions and to analyze each step as Rabbi Weiss presented. And Rabbi Jonah, who is one of the foremost commentaries on the ethics of the fathers, is a really astute psychologist. And Rabbi Weiss always mentions to me, you know, the fact that he is really a cognitive therapist, even though he never heard the term. But it's not the term, it's the concept. And this has been the tradition of Judaism all the way back, to recognize the importance of the knowledge of psychology in combination with the proper philosophy. That combination is really the key in terms of Judaism. And I one time mentioned that philosophers have raised the question. They say, well, if the Torah is a system of ethics, so why didn't the Torah organize its ethics like Aristotle's ethics? Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics is a whole system of ethics. Where do you find, why does the Torah have these stories? But the answer is because the Torah recognizes the psychological aspect. And in the psychological area, dynamics is most important. In other words, to see the dynamics of a situation, the dynamics of the emotions, the quantities of the emotions, that can only be portrayed with a living example. When Joseph is in a state where he confronts the wife of Potiphar, so that's a dynamic situation. You see, it's more than you must have the dynamics in order to be able to understand how these great individuals were able to conquer their emotions, to be able to be rational with regard to their expression of a way of life. And that's why the Torah uses examples, not just a book of ethics. I think that that's something that the Greeks, with all respect to their abilities in abstract philosophy, that's something that was overlooked, the importance of the dynamics of the emotions. Before I get started, I just want to convey my wife's warmest regards and feelings for everyone here. I mean, every time I speak with her, she says, always remember, you know, give my regards to this one, that one, and the list got so long that I just feel that I should just simply publicly express the fact that she's really sorry that she couldn't be here, and it's only the impending birth of a grandson that would prevent her from being here with us today. Soon. There's something that was funny that yesterday as we returned to the room, so Rabbi Weiss and myself, I wanted to show him something from this book. It's an interesting book. It's called The Joy of Insight, and it's The Passion of a Physicist, Victor Weisskopf. And he was a brilliant physicist. He was with all the greats, you know, Einstein and Bohr and Pauli. He was with the entire group that really ushered in the new physics. And I always enjoy reading the lives of these people because they do have brilliant minds. And I always find here and there some interesting points. And it's funny, I hadn't completed the book, but I wanted to show Rabbi Weiss something, and I just happened to open up this page, I mean, just fortuitously, to this page which I hadn't yet gotten to, and it was exactly what we were discussing here yesterday. And I'll just read you this paragraph. Now, this is an assimilated Jew. This is a Jew that was raised in the high culture of Vienna. I mean, he kept Christmas, and, you know, his religion was basically going to the plays and, you know, soaking in the culture and the environment of Vienna. And they abandoned, the family had abandoned Judaism totally, as many families during that time did. He writes that when he went to Israel, and he writes about a friend of his that he went to visit there, that he noticed that when he used to see him in Vienna, he was always, he lost his confidence because of anti-Semitic attacks, and it changed his whole character. Then he saw him in Israel, and he said he was like a different person. But then he goes on, he says, during my first visit to a synagogue, okay, I was impressed by the holy character of the scroll, which the rabbi took out of a golden chest during the service. Okay? It was not a picture or a statue, not a religious relic. It was a book, the symbol of learning and scholarship. Okay? These experiences made me more conscious of the significance of my being Jewish. I consider it a privilege to belong to a heritage that highly values things cultural and intellectual. Okay? So here is an example, and, you know, David always says, I always quote him on that, I think it's one of the best quotes that I've heard, that given the chance, given the opportunity, a person will choose Torah. The problem is the opportunity has always been lacking and still is lacking. But here you have a man, a brilliant scientist, raised in a Viennese society. The first time he comes to a synagogue in Israel and he looks at a scroll and he's brilliant. And he says that which is true. Namely, that this is amazing. There's no statue here. There's no relic. This is a living work. This is what we respect. Ideas, concepts, knowledge. And then he realized for the first time he's proud to be part of this great heritage. So the Torah talks to a person in a clear language. The problem is that this language is not really available as much as it should be. And I really was, it was amazing. I just happened to open up to that part. But he mentions also Wolfgang Pauli, who was very close with Gershom Scholem, you know, and they went into Kabbalah and things like that. But I'll tell you honestly, I've read many, many biographies of physicists, and my conclusion is, I mean, of course, they were not religious, and you know, they came from an assimilated society, assimilated background, but I always notice a thirst there for a knowledge of Torah, and it comes out in strange ways. I mean, searching for Kabbalah, things like that, but that thirst is there because there is a tremendous gap in a human life. If you don't have a way of life, I don't care how much physics a person knows, and physics, the Torah respects physics, you know, in the system of the Talmud, in the hierarchy, physics is considered higher, more abstract, more difficult even than Talmud, okay, because physics means the secrets of God with which he created the universe. And as Nachmanides says, we know as much about this as a drop in the entire ocean. So the Talmud has a hierarchy. There's Talmud, and then there's the world of God's secrets in the universe, and then there's metaphysics, okay, that's called Maaseh Merkava. This doesn't mean to say that one could ever exhaust intellectually the area of Torah and Talmud. That doesn't mean that. But it still means that the nature of the subjects, there is a hierarchy of type of abstraction. So, but being nevertheless, be that as it may, a person cannot live a satisfying existence without having any knowledge or any way to approach life. And that really is the benefit and the gift of Torah. I would like to, it's a funny thing, what I'm going to speak about today, I know it's going to sound like this was intentional, but I guarantee you it wasn't, because in the yeshiva, and as a matter of fact, this has been taped already in the yeshiva, just to prove that it wasn't planned, but the area of Yishmael, and it's something that we were studying in the yeshiva, and I always like to, if I can, to share with you some of the things that we're really currently doing. The things that are going on in the yeshiva itself. And it just so happens that it's the area of Yishmael, and Dr. Shams was here, and I must say that the second part of my presentation, I am happy that I would feel a bit uncomfortable, because I know that it's it's against things that he believes in, but nevertheless, maybe on the contrary, maybe this was really for the good, because it just gives me an opportunity to express something, and that is that a lot of things that we learn from society, certain wisdom from society, we don't analyze. Just like Rabbi Weiss mentioned, we don't analyze the wisdom that we've received from our early youth. These so-called absolutes, like if you get a wet head, I remember as a child, that's what I was taught, if you get a wet head, you can get sick and die. Then when I got older, I realized that I've never heard of a case of someone dying from a wet head. And I realize how absurd it would be if a physician would say to someone, what happened to him? Oh, it's another case of wet head. He passed away. Take him out. But it takes a while for us somehow or other to catch up with these emotional beliefs. And they have a head start on us because we're programmed already into them. And that's by the way, the concept of, we say that the evil inclination in man starts when he's born, and the good inclination starts at bar mitzvah, about 13, because the evil inclination is the irrational part, which has that head start of 13 years. Then you start thinking, and then you start analyzing and seeing, whether these beliefs have any basis. But with regard to some of the things we say that, well, we have differences of opinions. We have differences of opinions, and we all have to compromise. This is something which is really false. It sounds nice, sounds beautiful, but when you think about it, it's untrue. Let me give you an example. Let us say, for instance, during the Copernican Revolution, if Copernicus or if Galileo maintained that the sun is the center of the solar system, and the church maintained the earth is the center of the solar system, or perhaps other the Ptolemaic system, actually there were scientific views that the earth is the center. But if these two people would get together and they would sit down and say, look, you say the sun is the center of the solar system, I say the earth is the center of the solar system, we have to compromise here. There's something we have to get together and simply compromise the situation. Maybe we'll say one day it's like this, whatever. You understand yourself how absurd such an idea is. It's ridiculous. Okay? Last words of Galileo, after they forced him to recant, the church forced him to recant, under his breath he said, but it still goes around the sun. You see? Now, when it comes to truth, there cannot be any compromise. If religion is nothing more than an expression of our emotions, then you have to compromise, and compromise makes sense. You say, why should my emotions be superior to yours? I feel like doing this, you feel like doing that. Who says that I am superior to you? Or who says you are superior to me? Then we should compromise. Makes perfect sense. But if religion is something more than just emotions that we project onto reality, but there's something true and real, there is a true religion, then you understand compromise is impossible. You cannot negotiate truth. Okay? You can respect another person, and here again we have these aphorisms, which is, you must respect other people's opinions. Okay? When you think about it, that again is not true. You cannot respect a stupid opinion unless you respect stupidity. Okay? So if another person has an opinion which is ignorant, foolish, false, and harmful, you can't respect that opinion. It's silly. You could respect the person, that is possible. Okay? You could say, I respect this person. You can respect his right to his opinion. That's fine. That makes sense. Sometimes he doesn't have a right to his opinion. I wouldn't respect Hitler's rights to his opinions. Okay? But there are situations where it's rational to respect another person's right to his opinion, especially in an area where things are subjective. There are many subjective areas of life, okay, where opinion is the only thing that really one can use and perhaps should use. So, again, we can respect other people, but when it comes to the truth, one must just have respect for one thing, and that is foreknowledge. Okay. With that introduction, I proceed with the story of Yishmael. Now, before I get into the heavy part, I would like to just continue with the storyline. Just give me an idea of how much time we're going to have left, so I'll be able to gauge this on it. 45? Okay, good. All right. Now, in describing the method of Torah again, I said there's a certain crypticism in the text that always is a signal to look further, look more deeply. Something funny is going on here. And you find this in the continuation of the story of Hagar. And over here, you'll take a look. What happened was, as we said, mentioned last time, that she was driven out, or she drove herself out into the desert because she couldn't stand the way her mistress Sarah was treating her. So then she's in the desert, and she has a prophetic vision. And in the prophetic vision, the angel of God says to her, return to your mistress and suffer unto her. That's in 16:9. Okay? Next message. I will multiply your seed, and they will not be counted because of their a large number. And then again, you will become pregnant and conceive and give birth to a child, and you shall call his name Yishmael, because God has heard, listened to your pain. Okay? All right. The first mandate, of course, is to return, and in spite of the way how badly Sarah is treating you, don't let it bother you. And again, I just brings to mind the statement of the rabbis. The rabbis say that if you are with a scholar, even if he mistreats you, stick with him. And if you're with an ignoramus, even if he's nice to you, escape from him. Because what a person should look at, again, this is the rational approach in life, a person should look in life to improve himself. A scholar may not. And I want you to know something that Rabbi Weiss mentioned about righteous indignation. I studied under two great scholars, Rabbi Feinstein and Rabbi Soloveitchik. Both men unbelievably brilliant. To sit at their feet was like an awesome experience. But they had different personalities. And in Judaism does not seek to create a personality type. That's contrary to Torah. There are different personalities. The Talmud speaks about different types of personalities. Some were strict, some were kinder. Torah does not legislate personality. That personality is an individual thing which we are born with. God does not want us to mold up a certain personality type. He wants us to use wisdom with regard to our own inner type of personality. And Rabbi Feinstein was the kindest personality I have ever seen. Really kind man. Rabbi Soloveitchik was a different type. He was tough. Totally different. But again, as I said, different scholars, different personalities. But Rabbi Feinstein was the kindest man I've ever met. And he was intelligently kind. I've never seen him get angry, except one time. One time I was walking in the street with him, and we were discussing a halachic question that had to do with a conservative rabbi. And I saw him really get angry. I couldn't believe it. And I realized that his anger was not a personal anger. It wasn't anything personal about it. It wasn't that he wanted recognition and he cared about this conservative rabbi who lives out in the Midwest somewhere as an unknown, total unknown anyways. What bothered him was the distortion of Torah. He couldn't tolerate the idea that people are being misled by nonsense and people's lives are being wasted. That was an example came to my mind of of righteous indignation. Okay. So over here, the angel of God gave her good advice. He said to her, he said, what you must look for is, you must look for a life which is going to improve. It may be painful, it may be inconvenient. Your Sarah may be mean to you, but you're going to learn great things there. Go back. Suffer. It's okay. That's the same advice that the Talmud says. A scholar, you may find a scholar who has a very harsh personality. He's busy. He's not exceptionally kind. Stay with him. You're going to gain from him. Your friend who's very nice to you may be pleasant, but you're just going to waste your time with him. You'll drink beer with him. You'll watch television. You're just going to waste your life. So don't go for what feels comfortable. Go for what's going to improve your life. That's difficult. That takes rational therapy. You have to think, be able to think about that. So here the angel of God gives her this advice. Go back. It's painful. That's where you should be. Again, the angel of God tells her that she's going to have many children. She's going to be a matriarch of a great nation. Okay? And then he says in specific, you're going to have this child. His name is Yishmael. You should call him Yishmael. Why? Because God has listened to your pain. Okay? And I just want to mention as an aside, in the Torah, the concept of names, usually, it is, you see, a child is really a person's sense of immortality. We all know intellectually that we're mortal, but it's very difficult for us to have our emotions in line with that fact. As we get older, that's one of the benefits of old age, I think, is that you come to grips more with your mortality. The whole book of Ecclesiastes is really the subject of confronting your mortality. That's what the whole book is about. So over here, what happens with a name is like this. A child, however, is something, represents a part of our immortality, because we know that this represents a lineage that can go on and on and on. And in a way, that's true. That's the concept of Torah. You do partake of immortality in that sense. In the sense that you may die, but the ideas that you've set up go on in other people. That happens to be true. In one sense, it's good. Depends on which way a person thinks about it. But over here, in general, the names of a child, like, for instance, by Leah, she said, Judah, this time I will praise God. Okay? So, what the patriarchs, the matriarchs, what they were doing was like this. They were taking this sense of immortality and tying it to a theme that exhibited God's attributes, an attribute of God. This way they're immortalizing not their ego, but a concept that has to do with God's attributes. That's in general. That's the same thing that the angel said. Call him Yishmael, because this is an attribute that God listened to your pain. And we'll see a little further what exactly that means. Now you take a look at verse, I'm going to skip verse 12, because that's a little problematic. We'll get back to that. But the verse 13 follows immediately from verse 11, actually. Verse 13 is after the prophecy, and what did she do? Now take a look. You don't have the Hebrew, unfortunately. I'll have to give you a translation. I don't know which translation you have. This is one of those sentences that there must be, must be several translations, because there's no way to accurately translate this. But I will give you a literal translation. And she called the name of God that spoke to her, "You are the God." Now the next word, we don't know what it means. It means seeing, for sure, okay? Does it mean seeing me? Not precisely. Some think it's a contraction. Seeing my pain. Roeb anyi. It could be. We'll have to just leave it, okay? But we know the general idea, seeing. Onkelos, the proselyte, he translated it as the God that sees all, okay? Which it makes perfect sense within the framework. So at any rate, it says, let's go a little further. It says, because she said, now here's the difficult part, and this you'll never get in a translation. Hagam halom, because also even here I have seen after I have seen. Okay? Now when the Torah does this, you know immediately what the Torah is signaling to you is that there is a deep concept here. You can read it, but you see right away, it's obvious by the fact that this crypticism is supposed to clue you in that there's a concept here. Okay, because it just doesn't make sense. I have seen here, even here I have seen, after I have seen. What is after? What's before? What's she talking about? Okay? Now, last time, we developed the concept, if you remember, from the beginning part of the story. The concept was that there are two ways that a person partakes of God's blessings. One way is because he deserves it, okay? He rightfully deserves it. We do believe that if a person is righteous, God gives him his reward. He's entitled to it, and he gets it. And God does not, the rabbis say, God does not withhold a fraction of what a person deserves rightfully, okay? Because God is just in all his ways. But there's another kind of situation where you can benefit. And that is where God implements a plan, okay? He's implementing a plan, and the one that is most deserving at the time receives it. Okay? Do you understand what I'm saying? That is, like, for instance, the system of Torah. That's a divine plan. There must be this system of Torah in existence. Who receives it? The people that are able at the time to accept it. Okay? Now, what she said was a very profound idea. What she said was like this. You see, she left the house of Abraham. And you remember how she thought at first that she's the one that's going to usher in the blessings of Abraham. Okay? In other words, she was working with the concept that God has a plan and she could be part of this plan. She got very excited. But she got too excited because it led her to believe that she's superior and she could judge superiority and inferiority based upon who's in this plan. Okay? That was a mistake. But she was very involved in this plan. And she recognized in the house of Abraham that Abraham was living under a plan. Because God said, go leave your household, I'll bless you, I'll make you into a great nation. So she was living right in that plan, and she thought she was actually in it. Then she was driven out. Okay. So when she was driven out, what did the angel say to her? The angel said to her, he consoled her. He said, you are a very worthy person. I want you to know that you are an Anna, and you should know, from the information we have from the rabbis, who was Hagar? Hagar was a wonderful person. The rabbis say when it says that Abraham took another wife after the passing of Sarah, and her name was Keturah, so the rabbi says that comes from Keturah, which is the incense, and her actions were as beautiful as the incense, which is fragrant as the incense. So the rabbis of the time would tell us that Hagar was a great woman. Now here again, we get into the point of judging people. She made a mistake. True. But we cannot judge. We have no right to make the judgment and say, because she got carried away with her ego, that's why she is a bad person. Only God judges people. We don't judge people. Everyone makes mistakes. As I said, that is the greatest lure and temptation of man. The Torah recognizes that. So the angel of God, once she was reduced by Sarah, no doubt, she started to think, you see. And she was thinking about her life, and she was in a state of depression. She ran away. But the angel of God said to her, no, you're a great person, and you're going to be the matriarch of a great nation. Okay? Why? Because God has listened to your pain, which means that God looks at you, Hagar. Forget about the system. The system is one way that God relates to man, but there's another way that God relates to man, and that is you as an individual, you as a person. You have a personal value, a great personal value. You made a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes. That's part of life. But you are a great person, and a great person always retraces their steps. And so I made a mistake. I was right. Right now I see this is the way to go. And she was that kind of a person. The rabbis tell us that she was an extreme. You can understand yourself. Living in the house of Abraham, the person was not an ordinary individual. And that's why the angel told her that you, as an individual, God has listened to. That's what she said. She said, she called, and listen carefully to this verse. It's a beautiful verse. She called the name of God that spoke to her. What does it mean she called the name of God? What is the expression? Okay? What is the name of God? The name of God is when we use a name, we say, there are many names that we use for God. As a matter of fact, we say, Rachum, kind, Hanun, the one that's all-giving, almighty, okay, my master, all these names. Why do we have so many names for God?
The answer? The answer is we have names for God because we recognize there is no one name that we could use to identify God because he's beyond any kind of definition. So the names are the aspects of God that are revealed to us. We know he is one. That's the center of our faith. He is one. He doesn't have many attributes. He's not composed of attributes or components. But attributes from this one source, things come to us. It's like Maimonides gives an example. He says, fire is one thing, but fire can blacken. It can soften certain objects. It can make other objects hard. It has multifarious expression. He uses it as an example. It's an excellent example. But of course, it's an example from the creation. But with that example, we can approach the concept. And the concept is that this one God, who we can't give any one name to because we can never define him, but there are different expressions that come to us from this one God. That's what we call attributes. So look how beautifully she said. She was not an idolater. She was a wise woman. She said she called the name of God that spoke to her. It means that attribute that was reflected in that prophetic vision. What did she call it? She said, you are the God that sees all. You are the God that sees my pain. Why? Because she said, now look carefully what she said. She said, even here I have seen after I have seen. What does she mean? The oral law gives us the clue again. After I have seen means after I have seen in the house of Abraham. I have seen again over here. What she said was as follows. In the house of Abraham I saw God being expressed in terms of his plan. But now I see another aspect of the Creator right here in the desert just because of my own self-worth. That's why she says, Acharei Ekel Ro'i, the God that sees all and sees my affliction. Because I have seen over here in the desert away after, again, after I have seen the first time, which is in the house of Abraham. Which means now she sees that God relates to her, not just in terms of his plan, which she was removed from, but not at this point. At this point, even Abraham thought that Ishmael was going to be the one that's going to take over. But she saw that the angel told her that she, as a person, is recognized by God, and because of her value, her intrinsic value, she will be a great matriarch. Mother of a great nation. Okay. So there you have, the verse opens up once you understand the concepts behind it. The two ways that we receive the blessings of God. Two different frameworks. Okay. Now I'm going to go back to the verse that the angel told her before and explain what it is, because it seems, at first it seems disturbing and it's supposed to be consoling. I'll ask someone to read me their translation. It is 16:12, okay? It speaks about the type of person Ishmael is going to be. It's important. What translation do you have there? Okay, donkey, I guess. Pera Odom. All right, now literally it means pera. In Jeremiah, you have that same word. Para means a wild donkey. Okay. A wild donkey of a man. Doesn't sound too good. All right. Then it continues. What does it say?
His hand shall be against every man and every man's hand against him.
Right. His hand will be against every man's hand against him. And what does it say next?
He shall dwell over against all his kinsmen.
Yes. He'll dwell in the face of all his kinsmen. Okay. Now, I want to explain this to you. It seems strange when you read that. You think, what kind of consolation is that? I mean, to say that you can have a wild donkey of a man, I mean, no one would be happy to hear that. But again, with the benefit of the oral law and with the knowledge of Torah, we can understand this verse very, very well, you see. Torah maintains, and if you ever, it's translated, by the way, you have the Introduction to the Ethics of the Fathers by Maimonides. Now he explains that there are two kinds of virtue as a basic principle in Torah. One kind of virtue is natural abilities. We recognize natural abilities. In other words, Raw courage. A person has to have courage, has to be courageous. Is that true courage, ultimate courage? No, no. It's just a personality kind of courage, but it is a virtue. In other words, a person who is so meek and is so frightened, a frightened personality can never become great because he's too frightened to do anything, cannot accomplish anything. It requires courage in order for a person to be able to accomplish something. But just emotional courage is nothing, because emotional courage is a person who runs in front of a firing line because he wants to be a great hero. He's foolish. Okay? So real courage is when a person has the ability to control all the emotions and follow his mind, no matter how difficult he is. When he knows this is the right thing to do, he's able to do it. That's a supremacy of knowledge. That's real courage. But that requires more than just a personality. Okay? That requires years of study and to have the knowledge first and then to be able to live in line with that. The angel of God, you see, was not predicting over here what this person, Yishmael, would do with his traits. That wasn't the purpose. See, a prophecy doesn't always give you what you want to know. The prophecy gives you information, but that God determines what that information is. You can't determine that. What the angel, and why this was a consolation, was really it was not a statement which was derogatory. On the contrary, it meant a wild donkey of a man really means, as Rashi explains, it means a person that lives in the deserts. It means basically he was going to be a courageous individual, not a frightened personality. A frightened person can't live alone in the desert. To be able to take on the forces of nature requires courage. And then it says not only the forces of nature, but he's not going to be afraid of any man either. He is going to be a tough individual, not going to be frightened of anybody. And because of that, because he's not going to be frightened, because he's going to have courage, and because he is going to exert himself, other people are going to start hating him. That's a natural thing. There's no such thing as a leader who isn't hated. Because he is leading certain people, others people get jealous. So he will be courageous in terms of the forces of nature, will not be afraid to live alone in the desert, and he'll be courageous against man too. And they will in turn want to destroy him, will have enemies. But he will dwell upon the face of his brothers. He will succeed. Okay? Now this was, the angel was telling her a good thing. He was telling her his personality traits, strong personality traits. That's basically what the angel... And where do these traits come from, by the way? Abraham played a role in that. Because Abraham, we know, was famous for his courage. And I've mentioned many times, Socrates was considered a very courageous man. Okay, he went to his own death. And because he spoke the truth. And he definitely was a courageous man. But Abraham was even more courageous, because Socrates cut it short when it came to the religion of the state. He never really went against the religion of the state, even though he knew it was false. Abraham went against the religion of the state, and because of that, his life was in jeopardy, and he escaped miraculously from the city of Ur. That was a greater courage. So Yishmael has this raw courage too. Abraham had raw courage too, but he had the highest level of courage as well. The angel doesn't say what he's going to do with these traits. That's free will. Okay? As a matter of fact, to support this, I'm going to use a little bit of it, take you along in a little bit of a Talmudic kind of twist. But in the last verse of that chapter, 17, it says that Abraham was 86 years old when Hagar gave birth to Yishmael. Alright. So Rashi raises the question. He says, what's the importance of this? Well, why does the Torah mention this? Now, the Torah doesn't mention anything for nothing. So he says, no. He says, the importance of this is that it teaches you that Yishmael was 13 when he was circumcised, and he willfully did it. Okay, because if you know Abraham was 86, you know when he was 13 years later he was 99 when he circumcised himself, so you know that Yishmael was 13. Okay, so someone raised the question, say, how could Rashi, such a great scholar, make such a statement? Because the Torah says openly that Yishmael was 13 years old. Just take a look at the verse one chapter later. It says in 1725, Yishmael was 13 years old. Now Rashi knew the next chapter in the Bible, So what is Rashi saying over here? Why do we have to deduce how old he was from the chronology of Abraham? It says it openly. But the answer, I believe, is very simple. Rashi knew that, but what Rashi is telling you is that was important to mention here also, in this chapter. Because in describing the raw courage of Yishmael, the primary example was given. That he went to the circumcision at the age of 13, he knew it was God's commandment, and he was happy to do it. And it didn't bother him at all, even though in those days it was a very difficult operation. Okay? So it shows even as a youth he had that courage. Okay. Now, Yishmael, of course, you understand, when you read a little bit into the Torah, not just read the Bible again, you understand Yishmael was a beloved son of Abraham. A beloved son of Abraham. If you take a look, and that's what we're going to do, we're going to go further into the storyline, because the storyline continues later, okay, in 21:9. And, of course, Hagar came back to the house of Abraham with this Yishmael, and then we find again another incident. Bad incident. What happened is that Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian who gave birth to Abraham, and then the next word, what's your translation in the next word? The last word in verse 9 of 21, chapter 21, what's your translation? Plain. What do you have? Mocking, playing. The plain interpretation is being frivolous, playing. Okay. Again, you see the cryptic method. Because what does it mean, playing? What's wrong with playing? The Torah doesn't say anything. Stops right there. Playing, that's it. Doesn't give you more of a clue than that. And then it says in verse 10, and she said to Abraham, chase out this maidservant and her son, because the son of this maidservant will not inherit with my son Isaac. Okay? And the Torah tells us in verse 11, and this thing was very bad, in the eyes of Abraham, about this incident about his son. Okay? So he was very upset about it. Now you see that Yishmael, obviously, you can start putting it together. Take a look again where God came to Abraham and he said, he gave him the news that he's going to have a son, Isaac. Because first he told him he's going to have children. But then he said to him, you're going to have a son, Isaac. Take a look at 17. And Abraham fell on his face and he laughed and he said in his heart, will a man of 100 years old give birth to a child with a woman of 90, okay? You see right there, by the way, it's a beautiful verse. It shows you that Abraham never looked for miracles, did not look for miracles, because his God was the God that was revealed through wisdom and knowledge. So when he heard that God's going to change his law, he was surprised. And then what does he say in 18? And Abraham said to God, Lu Yishmael Yechiyeh Lefanecha. He says, you don't offer me so much. I'm happy if Yishmael will live before you. You see, at this time he thought the Yishmael was going to be the one that's going to carry on the whole system. So, what do you see? What do you gain? What knowledge do you gain from this? Yishmael was a beloved son of Abraham. And Abraham taught him, he was in his house. He was a fine person. Okay, Abraham wouldn't make a mistake. Abraham was an individual that was completely intact with other people. He knew people. He was a man of the world. Now, so what happens here? So Sarah sees Yishmael. We don't know how old he was at the time. 15, 16? Teenager probably at that time. And she sees him playing. Okay? So she says, chase out this son of this maidservant. Okay? Now Abraham feels very bad. So then in verse 12, in 21:12, God comes to Abraham and he says, don't feel bad. And you don't let it be bad in your eyes about the young lad and about your maidservant. Whatever Sarah says to you, you listen to her voice. Why? Because in Isaac will be called, Yikare, will be called for you a son. Okay. This story is strange. We don't understand what what the story, what's happening here. Abraham and Sarah are two intelligent people. Sarah says, chase him out. Chase out your son. And Abraham feels bad about it. Well, what did he think? Did he think she was right? She was wrong? I mean, what transpired? What was going on between them? And then God says, don't feel badly. Whatever Sarah says, do. Why? Because Isaac is going to be the one that's going to be called a son. So what? What's that going to do with it? But he felt bad. He's losing his son. How can he chase his son out and just let him go? After all, it's the most difficult thing for a person to do. So we have to understand what was this playing and what was this argument? Was it an argument? Was it a discussion? What was going on here? And then God comes in and says, just listen to our voice. We have one clue from the rabbis here, from the Talmud, the Oral Law. And the Oral Law really sets this whole story on its proper, aligns the story properly, on its center. And that is, the rabbis say, with that sensitivity for the text, when God said, listen to her voice, God didn't say she is right. He didn't say that. He said, listen to her voice. And the rabbis say there's a difference. You see, there's a story later in Genesis with Isaac and Esau and Jacob. And I'm sure you're familiar with that. Now, Rebekah loved Jacob. But Isaac loved Esau. Now, he made a mistake over there. And the Torah, the way it portrays the story, you see, he was wrong. And the reason is, as I mentioned, Isaac was a certain kind of personality. He was not a man of the world. Abraham was a man of the world. Isaac was a recluse. Different kind of a life. You'll ask me, how could we have two different people? As I said before, the Torah does not dictate personality. He was a different kind of personality. Isaac was a person that was completely involved in God's work, and he could not deal with the outside world. It wasn't him. Abraham was a fighter. He was able to deal with kings, treaties, influence people. He was really an outside man. But Isaac didn't have that ability, and Isaac was fooled by his own sons. Okay? He thought that Esau was really a wonderful person. Abraham, the Torah doesn't describe Abraham though. Abraham was very astute. He could tell people. So what happened over here? God says, listen to our voice. He doesn't say, she is right, you are wrong. He says, listen to our voice. What kind of a strange statement is that? So the rabbis say that what she was saying was prophecy. God says, listen to the voice means the voice of prophecy. Okay? Now let's try to unravel what's going on in these verses over here. We'll see an interesting thing. There's another thing out of line over here. You always got to look for those things that are out of line. If you take a look at verse 10, when Sarah says, chase out this maidservant and her son, so she gives a reason. What is the reason? She says, because this maidservant will not inherit with my son Isaac. Now, who's talking about inheritance here? Inheritance is a long way off. That's Abraham had a long time to live before there was any inheritance. So what is she saying about inheritance? She should have said, chase this boy out because he's an evil influence. What's it got to do with inheritance? But we take a look, the word inheritance, the word Yerusha, is used before in the Torah with regard to Abraham. Where is it used? It's used by the covenant of the parts. And that is in Genesis 15, beginning of Genesis 15, where it says that God appeared to Abraham in a vision, and he said, I am your shield, and your reward is great. So Abraham said, God, O God, what can you give to me? And I am going childless, verse 2, and the one who is the master of my household is Eliezer from Damascus. Okay? Now again, the rabbis tell us, Eliezer, that word Dameshek, they say, doesn't only mean Damascus, but they say it should really, a lot of times rabbis say something means something, they don't mean that's the actual meaning. They say use it as a hook. They say Dameshek should be broken up to Dole Omashke, which means he dipped in like into a well from the knowledge in the Torah of his master Abraham and Mashke, and he would give it out to others. So Dameshek Eliezer was a great man, student, foremost student of Abraham. But what was wrong was Abraham recognized something. He knew that God's plan cannot go on unless the next one in line to carry on this philosophy is his son, because that's human psychology. And he said, God, what can you give me? The one that's the inheritor of my house, who is the one that's going to inherit me, is going to be is Damascus Eliezer. So take a look at verse 4. And the word of God was to him saying, Lo Yerush Chazeh, this one will not inherit you. Who will inherit you? The one that comes out of your own loins, your own child. Okay? So then he took him out, showed him the stars, and says, so will be your children. Okay. So Abraham said to God, basically, it wasn't because Abraham personally wanted a child. We don't find in the Bible that Abraham asked God for a child, personally. But there's a medrash to that effect, but I'm just sticking with the text. The Abraham said to God that if the next one to carry on this philosophy is not my son, it's going to die. It's just not going to make it. And there's an interesting verse in last week's Sedra, and that is in Genesis 25, where it says, and this is the generations of Isaac, the son of Abraham. Abraham gave birth to Isaac. So the rabbi says, what do you have to repeat it in the same sentence twice? So the rabbis say that the people of the generation said that this child is not from Abraham, it's from Avimelech. Okay? Because they were together for the night. So it says, Abraham gave birth to Isaac means he looked just like him. So it was obvious that it was his son. And God did that intentionally so everyone should know that this is the son of Abraham. Why? Because people were saying when this old man Abraham dies, the whole philosophy is going to die. It's just a matter of time. He's old. Wait a few more years. No. It was obvious that Isaac was his son, carrying on the same philosophy, the same ideas, the same Torah. He dug the same wells. He did the exact same thing. It was Abraham all over again. Then the world was silenced, and they knew that the philosophy is going to continue. That's what Abraham basically said. So we have this word Yerusha, this word inheritance, which doesn't mean physical inheritance, monetary inheritance. It means an inheritance of the entire system of Torah. Okay? And I want you to know that the inheritance concept from that time on took on a totally different meaning in Torah. I'll give you an example. In Kings... Yeah, Marosha. Right. Torah Tziva Lana Moshe. Moses taught us Torah, which is an inheritance of the house of Jacob. Inheritance means an ideology. Now, I'll give you a beautiful story in Kings, where, you know, the king Ahab, he had a beautiful palace, and something bothered him. Right next to his palace was this little spot that belonged to Naboth, which would have been perfect for him as a garden. And every day he walked by, it disturbed him. One day he went over to Naboth. This is Kings 121. One day he went over to Naboth, and he says, look, he says, you know, you've got this garden. It's very nice. It's in the wrong spot for you. I will give you a better one. Or if you want, I'll pay you for it. And he wanted to take it for himself. What was Naboth's response? Naboth says, heaven forbid, Chalilali, heaven forbid for me to sell the inheritance of my ancestors. So I can't sell this for money. This is not money. This piece of land represents Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. This is my part of the Torah. I can't give this away. This is not subject for a sale. So it says Ahab went home that day, depressed, wouldn't eat, wouldn't drink. He turned his face to the wall. Why was he so depressed? He never encountered a situation where he couldn't get what he wanted. I mean, that's ridiculous. He was a king. I mean, everybody has experiences like that. What bothered him was when he saw this man who's in line with the truth, that showed that he's just living in a world of obsession. He's living in a world of obsession and money and power. And this little Jew, who knows who he is, never heard of him before, this guy is telling him, you're on the wrong track. What's money? The inheritance of the fathers, that's important. I can't give it up for money. He knew he couldn't. Ahab knew that he was not in that realm. The framework got him depressed, you see. There again, you see, the concept of inheritance is not transmission of a monetary object. It's an ideology. That's the concept of Israel, land of Israel, an ideology, as James Tabor told us yesterday. And that's why the rabbis say when the daughters of Tzelophchad went forth to Moses and asked for the land, they weren't interested in the money. They didn't complain about it wasn't the fact that they were saying it's unjust, the son inherits, the daughter doesn't inherit. These are God's laws, and we know that these laws are just, and they weren't complaining about it. But what they wanted was they wanted a part in the inheritance. They wanted a part in the land because it was an ideological claim. So the rabbis say the daughter of these women was superior to the men because the men said, let's go back to Egypt. They got frightened. And the daughter said, no, we want a part of this land. So land and inheritance is ideology. Now let's take a look into those verses. When you take a look at the verse, so it says that Sarah said she saw him playing. Now what does it mean, playing? See, playing is a very specific word. Because we mentioned before that every person is born with their own capabilities, their own abilities, their own instinctual life. The Torah recognizes. It's what the person does with it that makes the difference. But there is also such a thing as a person who is endowed with superior qualities. Okay, there is such a thing. And Moses was a unique person. Abraham was a unique person. We recognize that. We aren't all equal. The Torah never maintained we're all equal. We all have to be concerned with ourselves, but we're not all equal. Now, there are two types of righteous people. One type of righteous person is a person that's engaged in a struggle of control constantly. It's a righteous person. There's another kind of person who naturally is drawn towards the good. That's a different kind of person. I mentioned this in the Wednesday night class. And Maimonides states that the superior person is the one that's naturally drawn to the good. It has to be that way because his soul is superior because it sees the good and is attracted immediately. The other person is also righteous, but it's not the same kind of thing. Now, when she saw the playing, see, the playing wasn't anything evil. He was a wonderful boy. But the playing was an expression of the fact that he is very instinctual in his makeup. Doesn't mean he's going to be an evil person. He could be a very righteous person. But that is his makeup. Playing is where a person gives vent to their instincts in some sublimated form. Okay. So Sarah said to Abraham, this is not, chase this man out. Chase this boy out. Why? Because he's not the one that is capable of taking over the inheritance. You see, the inheritance meant the ideology. Because the world was looking to Abraham, who's going to be the next in line? Who is Abraham appointing next? So Sarah, with her prophecy, she said, there's a big danger here. This Ishmael, he could be a great man, true. But he's not the one that's going to be able to carry on the system. He doesn't have those abilities. His nature, he's very instinctual in nature. And he could be a good person, but there's a difference between a good person and one that's capable of carrying on the system. So what she said was, if you allow him to stay here, he is going to lay claim after your death. He is going to lay claim to the fact that he has the ideology. So it will come out that after you die, there are going to be two ideologies in your name. One is Isaac, and one is Ishmael. And while Ishmael may in truth be a virtuous person, but he has one problem. The same problem that his mother had, and that is that because control of the instincts is essentially ego-centered, the ego sometimes gets lost. Just like the case with Hagar. She was a righteous person, but she got taken away. And a person like that is not capable of representing the system, because what's going to happen is he's going to fail, and he's going to twist the system to agree with him. So that was a prophecy that she saw at that time, that he was not capable of doing that. And that's why she said, send him out, because if he's out, he can't lay claim to anything. He wasn't there. The prophecy of Sarah took place 2,300 years later, when Islam laid claim to the ideology of Abraham. But she forestalled it by 2,300 years. And because of that, the claim has no real legitimacy when you analyze it logically. But that's precisely the prophecy that the Torah is speaking about. Okay.